You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Bonnie Panofsky is a flawed man who admits to all of his errors in life and love in Mordechai Richler's award-winning novel Barney's Version, a new film adaptation of it starring Paul Giamatti, Dustin Hoffman, Minnie Driver, and Rosamund Pike opens this coming Friday at the Union Square and Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and I'm very pleased that it brings director Richard J. Lewis and Rosamund Pike to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Although Paul Giamatti, Dustin Hoffman, and Minnie Driver have worked a lot in films, haven't both of you come to this movie after working extensively in other genres? In your case, Rosamund, you have done a lot of films, but it's my sense that theater is your base of operations. Am I wrong?
Partially wrong, I would say.
Oh, okay.
I said a while ago that I'd always like to do one play a year, and it was actually, fortunately, I was doing a play at the time that Richard Lewis was casting Barney's Version, because I went to meet him for a much smaller role, and he happened to come and see my play and think...
What was that, Madame de Sade?
Madame de Sade, a play with Judi Dench, which happened to span a number of decades, and gave him the idea that I could be right for Miriam. So
She had so much text, too. It was like she carried the show. Earlier that afternoon, she had auditioned for a smaller part, Clara, the first wife of Barney Panofsky. And she was great, but she was, you know, too eloquent and too elegant. Mm-hmm. And so I went to see her that night at the show, and she was just wonderful. And I thought, this could be Miriam.
Well, typecast as elegant characters, even when you're playing villains in James Bond films. But so we'll never see Madame de Sade in New York with Judi Dench, or even more sad for New Yorkers, we won't see Hitchcock Blonde on Broadway.
Well, Hitchcock Blonde, we tried so hard to bring it to Broadway, but it was one of these complicated plays where there were a number of pieces of film equipment on the stage, which when you come to New York, you get involved with the unions of it all. So, you know, lights cannot be turned on by actors and things like that. And it just became too expensive. The cost started escalating, and it sadly didn't come. But
you appeared totally nude at that play, didn't you?
I might have done. I think actually I had a pair of high heels on, so I don't call that totally nude, do you?
Richard, you've directed and produced any number of shows in the hit series CSI for nine seasons. Was CSI a good preparation for making a film like this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, especially in Italy, it got us out of Italy somehow, because we were very pressed for time. We had to cram a lot of material into short shooting days. The Italian crews don't like to work long hours. So, you know, there was a certain pace that I was used to that I was able to enact in Italy. But also, you know, working, shooting that many television episodes over the course of a span of time prepares you to, you know how to get a scene on its feet and get it working and work with really good actors.
Well, some of the scenes in the film take place in Italy, but most of it's in Canada.
This is correct.
Did you shoot Canada in Italy?
No, surprisingly enough, we shot Canada for Canada, which is rare because most of the time Montreal's playing New York. Mm-hmm. We shot Montreal for Montreal, we shot New York for New York, and we shot Rome for Rome, which was nice.
It's a wonderful treat to do that. And this, you know, this novel's so steeped in Montreal that to be there and to be, in the vicinity of all the places that are in the novel was magic. And our producer is a particular stickler for accuracy. So even though the Ritz-Carlton Hotel is being converted into condos, he was adamant that we would film there because Mordecai and his wife used to go to lunch there every day. And so he actually delayed the demolition of the building in order for us to film there and reconstituted the garden.
Including having ducks in the pond that needed to get there a month early so that they wouldn't fly away. They had to raise the ducklings in the pond itself.
So that they'd be obedient when we came to shoot
them.
I'm not sure you actually do see them in the film in the end.
Yes, they're in. Absolutely. I mean, I made sure those shots had the ducks.
Had this been a novel that you had liked in the past? Were you familiar with Mordechai Richler's?
Yes.
Richard probably had this in his head as long as CSI, right?
Yeah. No, I read the book in 99, just after it came out, and I was a huge fan of it. I couldn't believe the sort of, you know, how tailor-made this Barney Panofsky was for the cinema.
Really? Because in the book, he is telling his story. It's called Barney's Version because it's his version of the story.
Right.
And he is a difficult man. He has to rationalize his way through an awful lot of stuff. That's harder. that's something that's harder to get across in a movie, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, originally, when I had adapted, I had written a couple of the drafts myself, starting around 2006, and I had the first-person narrative still.
A lot of voiceover.
A lot of voiceover, which, you know, ultimately was problematic, and that's why we brought Michael Konovies in to write his brilliant draft that we ended up shooting. But, you know, I felt like the voice of Mordechai's voice would be, it was so difficult to let go of. I couldn't let go of it. And so I incorporated it sparsely into that draft. But at the core of what I thought was wonderful was this intimate character study set against this epic backdrop, you know, two continents, three wives, you know, and 40 years of life.
Rosamund, you play the role of Miriam Barney's main love interest, his third wife. Beautiful, intelligent, patient, extremely patient, considering how difficult Barney can be at times. While Barney is impetuous, excessive at times, vulgar. So, how, as an actress, did you rationalize the relationship?
It's funny. Everyone asks this question, and I find it sort of totally simple to understand. I mean, I think, you know, luckily Miriam is the woman she is, because she benefits from all Barney's wonderful qualities, because she's able to put up with, you know, the negative bits. She is endlessly patient, as you say. But, you know, I think sometimes these sort of narcissistic, excessive loons, you know, are the people who are most fun to be around. You know, he's a man of huge appetites. He'll see every one of them through, and it's exhilarating. I mean, the way these two meet is so crazily kind of romantic and also disturbing.
We can't call it cute. They don't meet cute, but they do meet.
They meet interestingly. They meet at Barney's wedding to his second wife, and Miriam is a guest, almost an uninvited guest at the wedding. He sees her, and is just hit by the realization that he is just 2 hours ago married completely the wrong woman, and he goes out on a limb and says, "You know, I never thought I believed in true love. I do." And it's not sort of schmaltzy. Paul plays it brilliantly because it's this sort of wonderful, humorous, sad, tragic realization.
Right, and you play it beautifully too. There's a really interesting shot just after Barney chases her onto the train and professes his love for her.
Wait, he runs out of his wedding.
He leaves his own wedding.
This is the reception.
The character played by Minnie Driver, who, by the way, does seem like an appropriate wife for this guy.
Yes, in certain ways. Although he's not in love with her. It's sort of a reactionary marriage. But he chases her onto the train. He leaves after professing his love, and we're left with Rosamund and this expression on her face in which you can't really tell whether she's tickled, upset, horrified. It's somewhere in between. It's a very sort of ambiguous kind of expression on your face.
Intrigue, I think.
Yes, but it's quite delicious.
Yeah.
In spite of his arrogance, Barney is his own biggest critic. He even calls his film production company Totally Unnecessary Productions. Is it Barney's ability to see his own shortcomings that ultimately makes him a sympathetic character?
Oh, I mean, the voice of Barney is just completely irresistible. You know, he is a man with great humor, and even sort of through his, you know, through the tragedies, he maintains a sort of wit and irony around himself. I mean, you know, and it's wonderful because the film counterpoints Barney with this sort of other character who's his main love rival, this man called Blair, who does everything right, you know, is politically correct, vegan, great sort of woodsman, can mend cars, boats, you know, everything that Barney is completely incompetent at.
He has a kind of tragic self-awareness.
Blair is sort of unself-aware completely.
Yeah, right? He goes about his life and puts one foot in the other. It's kind of like, Barney, in the novel, he says, I was aware of, suddenly I knew there was a monster, and the monster was me. And so that kind of self-awareness is quite tragic because he has this, he's not able to stop it. He's not able to stop the self-destruction, and he destroys his own happiness in the end, doesn't he?
He also is considered a monster by somebody else. There's a murder mystery subplot here. I don't want to reveal too much, but there's a lot. This is not just a matter of a man who screws up or has bad marriages.
No, that's the extraordinary thing about this film. You start talking about it, and you start talking about one element in great detail, and then realize that you've forgotten that there's a, you know, murderous subplot, a wonderful relationship between a father and a son, and actually a sort of meditation on parenthood and fathers and
Justin
sons.
Dustin Hoffman plays his father.
And then Dustin Hoffman's son plays our son. So there's a sort of nice continuity there. But, you know, the show meant so many different elements that it's easy to sort of get sidetracked and forget how rich a canvas this film really is.
I mentioned earlier that perhaps you're typecast as a sophisticated woman because your publicity material points out you're fluent in French and German. You're a skilled cellist. Your parents
were
musicians.
It's all lies, I'm afraid. I'm so sorry to...
Studied at Oxford. Here you play a radio broadcaster who lives in New York. You don't reveal a trace of a British accent. Are American accents that easy to affect these days?
I just, before I answer that, I should point out that really the only bit of serious typecasting probably went on in an education, except that nobody realizes that probably playing the airhead is actually closer to the truth. Say that again, losing the British accent.
We have Minnie Driver in the film as well, also British, also doing a perfect American accent.
It's about,
in the old days, the Brits couldn't get American accents. Now they all seem to do them better than Americans.
I think it's our exposure to it, probably, that's what's changed. And also, I mean, I find it fascinating because I come from a musical background and it just takes a lot of very, very close listening. And it's, you know, it's very subtle work doing a dialect. It's very precise. And you have to work on all the different muscular movements of your mouth and then forget about them all and just be the character.
So this is almost like singing?
It's as precise and as technical as that, although, you know, like a good singer, you forget all the technicalities when you come to perform.
And she was,
but it's changing your lip shape, changing the way your tongue touches your teeth. I mean, it's... Right. it's.
And she was such a perfectionist about it. You have no idea. Oh. I mean, can you imagine? Anyway, she would come to me and she'd say, is this right hand? Hand. Well, it sounds a little Midwestern. Okay, hand. Hand. You know, and it, real. Remember the way you say real? Life is real. Real. I mean, and she'd go, real. You see her walking around and say, real, real.
Yeah.
And but it was so seamless for her and Minnie. I mean, and it's very impressive to me to hear her or you know, Christian Bale or someone do these kinds of dialects to the T. And we all, you know, we North Americans love to do our British accents, and they probably suck.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, can you imagine?
There are some American actors who do them well now. In the past, they always sounded fake.
Yes.
Now we have this weird situation where someone like Charlize Theron only speaks with an American accent in her everyday conversation.
So. Right, and she's South African, correct?
Yes.
Or someone like Gillian Anderson, who I've just worked with, is completely British when in England and converts to an American accent when talking to an American or in America.
Are you going to go back to television or is feature films where your future lies?
Well, I think it's more – to me, it's more more exciting to move in the direction of feature films. But television is great too. I mean, and there's lots of great stories to be told on either the small screen or the large screen. And so it doesn't really matter. For me, it's about the material and that I can direct.
The frustrations usually of television are – the time constraints.
You've done television too.
Well, I went back last year actually and did a two films of two D.H. Lawrence novels for the BBC. Wonderful script written by the same man who wrote Maid in Dagenham, which I'm also playing now and I'm in. But it was just the speed at which we had to shoot. You know, this amazing material, but we had to go so fast that, you know, sometimes...
I'm laughing because I can't imagine D.H. Lawrence on American television.
But there's another side. Some actors complain that when you do too many takes, the first take is often the best one.
I think that can be true. I mean, in this case, Richard actually had allowed Paul and I a wonderful period of rehearsal so that we could sort of develop these characters and develop an intimacy. And, you know, that suited both of us because everyone thinks that rehearsing is going to sort of, I don't know, stultify the final product, but I think it actually gives you freedom. It means you feel safe, so you can then play when it comes to the day, right?
And we didn't do a lot of takes. These guys are really good.
They're professionals.
They're thoroughbreds.
That's what you expect.
They're absolute thoroughbreds.
That's why you cast.
But I think you're right. Often the first one out the gate is often, because you surprise yourself then, because it's nerves play a part.
When Steve Martin was here recently, he mentioned that he's going to be in a new film with Owen Wilson, Jack Black, and with you, Rosamund.
Yes, I'm sure Steve Martin didn't mention that.
He did. Can you tell us about that?
I can tell you a bit. The funniest thing was that one of the things from my dialect is one of the things to change the O sound is something that, you know, English people find very hard when converting to American because we do this rather sort of closed O sound and, you know, a no in American is much more rounded and open. And So one of my little tricks that I do before to take is, no, 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 I don't loathe Owen. And then I find myself working with Owen Wilson, and I'm sort of walking around set chanting this little ditty. And he's like, I'm sorry, what did you say? but it's a comedy about competitive bird watching, which I feel, you know, is a subject matter that people are probably, you know, can't really understand why a movie hasn't been made about it before.
Well, to some degree, we could say Barney's version is also about competitive bird
watching. I totally agree, Leonard, yeah.
And I want to thank you for being on our show. Richard J. Lewis is the director of Barney's version, which opens this Friday at a couple of theaters here in New York, the Union Square and Lincoln Plaza Cinemas. And Rosamund Pike is one of the stars, along with Paul Giamatti, Dustin Hoffman, and Minnie Driver. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.